chain. Then I'll talk about where we should be looking for that, and a couple of different attempts that we've made for looking for signatures. So clearly, what we all want to learn about is parameters about inflation or whatever the initial conditions are. And I put this slide up here just to keep in mind that no matter what the initial conditions are, we can go out and measure the amplitude for scalar perturbations. We can measure the scale dependence of those scalar perturbations. We can look for tensor modes. We can look for the tensor spectral index. I should probably have added to here also isocurvature modes. And we can go out and look for non-Gaussianity. But we have, with some theoretical priors, like a model of slow roll inflation, all of these quantities that we measure can be related to some parameters. And in particular, there's simplifications because there are relationships between different parameters. There are fewer numbers to measure because really there are only so many slow roll parameters. And in particular, slow roll inflation, the amplitude of the non-Gaussianity is predicted to be very small. The shape is similar to the local model, which I'll remind you what it is again briefly. And the running is second order and slow roll parameters. So this is what you expect for these numbers within single field slow roll inflation. But you can make modifications to these assumptions. And in particular, I'll be talking about models of inflation, which are still single field models, but and they're sort of slow roll, but they have non-canonical kinetic terms, or which give rise to sound speed during inflation, which is not equal to the speed of light. So these models stick within having only one field, but give you interesting new effects. In particular, the slow roll parameters change. You now have factors of the sound speed popping up and things that depend on the where the scalar perturbations freeze out. And a new slow roll parameter is added, which depends on which tells you about how quickly the sound speed is changing. And most importantly, the non-Gaussianity is generically large. So if you calculate the three-point amplitude, you have terms which you still have these terms which are suppressed by slow roll parameters, but you also have terms which depend on the go like one over the sound speed. So for small sound speed, you get a large non-Gaussianity. The shape is different from slow roll, and you also have a running of non-Gaussianity, which is now first order in the slow roll parameters. So just to keep separate, there are things that we can measure no matter what, but this is also phenomenologically motivated. And this is one way of extending the slow roll paradigm and getting new relationships for all of these observables. I don't
have a simple explanation for that.
Yeah.
For those models, the higher derivative terms change the dynamics of the inflation, become non-slow. So those higher derivative terms, which is important for those non-slow dynamic, was they just have a
Okay, so if you would work with hydrodynamical matter for the fixed sound speed, you wouldn't get this formula.
I think the physical intuition is that you have a sound speed that is smaller than zero, right? So inflation is kind of moving up. But if you have a small sound speed, you know that the gene spine for the gravitational class, they would find it's like some counteracting force to the.
But I actually think that explanation doesn't quite work because you don't, the sound, there's not a fixed sign of the non-Gaussianity. Does that make sense? I mean, the sound speed is always less than one, so you always have more clumping in something, you always have more clumping in something with a smaller sound speed than you do in something with sound speed approaching one, but you can still get both positive and negative non-Gaussianity. I think the thinking about the gene's length doesn't quite work.
The most straightforward way is just that you have higher. The CS is just higher derivative terms.
Yeah. And the terms that are most important are ones that go like theta dot dot powers of theta. Okay, so an example of this is a DDI model. So DDI, for the non-strict cosmologists, is Dirac-Born-Infeld. And in this scenario, it's a model of brain inflation. So this picture, we would live on one of these D3 brains, which is extended in three dimensions. And the purple thing is a compactified six-dimensional Calabi-Yau. And if inflation occurs, the inflaton is the brain anti-brain separation. And inflation occurs as this brain falls into the throat. So what's novel about this as the action for the brain falling into the throat is like the action for a relativistic point particle. So it has a sort of Lorentz factor, which enforces a speed limit. So even though the potential can be steep, the kinetic energy is kept to be small by this speed limit factor. And in particular, you get a sound speed, which depends on this Lorentz factor. And notice the Lorentz factor gamma depends on the value of the field. So it means that it's changing during inflation. Okay? And the sound speed can either increase or decrease depending on whether the model, there are some models where the brain is falling into the throat and there are some where it's coming out. But the important point is that the sound speed depends on the scale, depends on the inflaton. So Xingang and Siri and others have worked out what the three-point function is for models of with arbitrary sound speed. So here, zeta is the primordial curvature perturbation. This is the definition of the power spectrum. So keep in mind that curvature perturbation is related to plus the density fluctuation. So regions with positive zeta will end up being overdense later. So you get a number of terms here. You get terms which are suppressed by slow roll factors, and then you get two terms which are larger. These are all model-dependent functions, but this can describe DBI inflation or K inflation or other models like that. In DBI inflation, this term vanishes, so this is the dominant term. So when I talk about, I want to be clear about something, is that a lot of the analysis we do doesn't depend on a particular model, but the DBI I'll use as an example, but a lot of what I'm talking about doesn't rely on using DBI. It could be true for any model of inflation with non-Gaussianity. The amplitude here is proportional to 1 over the sound speed minus 1, and the sound speed depends on k to the kappa, where that's the slow roll parameter. So what does this look like? Well, the three-point function by translational invariance is, gives you this delta function here. So that means that whatever is over here is a function of some triangle, unlike the power spectrum, which is restricted to be just a function of the magnitude of k. Here you have the something that's restricted to be a function of k1 plus k2 plus k3. So you can ask questions about what does this function look like. Well, it has some geometry dependence. And in this case, the models have a largest magnitude for triangles which are of the equilateral form. You can also ask what the scaling is. If I rescale all of the sides, how does this the amplitude of this change? If I scale all the sides by a, I pick up this factor of a to the sixth. This sort of comes from dimensionality. I have factors of n sub s minus 1 from the slow roll parameter, but I also have this factor of 2 kappa, which comes from that change in the sound speed. How does this compare to the local model of non-Gaussianity? Well, here I have a non-Gaussian field as a Taylor expansion about some Gaussian field. Notice that as long as FNL is constant, then if you want the variance of average of the Gaussian field to be the same as the non-Gaussian field, then you need FNL to be constant here. But you can just directly compute the three-point function, and in this case ask, what's the geometry dependence? Well, this is largest for squeezed triangles. And if I ask what the scaling of this is, I again have that factor of a to the sixth and the factors of the spectral index, but I don't have that kappa-dependent factor. So just to summarize and compare the two, sound speed models are largest for equilateral shape, whereas local, largest for squeeze shape. And if I look at the scaling, the difference in scaling comes from the fact that the sound speed can change during inflation. So you get an extra kappa-dependent factor there.
You don't have it.
It's not the FNL that scales in this behavior. It's that whole function.
Is it whole function?
So FNL itself does not scale. So these two models are different, but you want to compare the amplitude of non-Gaussianity in each one. So you can set, you can look at what this AC term is of KKK and compare it to A local, set all of the Ks equal to each other, and you get to any dependence on K here, you can cancel those K factors. So I can define an FNL for these models, which aren't really local models, but this, if I want to compare the amplitudes. So going forward, I'll use this amplitude FNL to describe the DBI model, but keep in mind that this sound speed factor can depend on K. So another picture of the geometry dependence here, you can see it's very different between the AC and A local. So AC is something that's derived from, that works for particular forms of sound sleep models like DBI, but there's also just this shape, which was proposed in this paper, which is very efficient for data analysis, which is just called the equilateral form. As you can see, the AC term here coming from DBI and this equilateral shape are quite similar. They differ by at most, like, I think about 30% in that plane. So so we can consider a particular model here, or I can just use the equilateral shape, but I'm going to have to define this FNL equilateral to match up with what I expect from these models. And in particular, I'm going to allow this equilateral part to depend on scale. I'll just put that in by hand, because it factorizes into different terms. But also, it's nice because a lot of the sound speed models, I mean, the dominant terms compare really well to this. So
so rather than compute your particular form, you could just use this and match between the two. So so I'll also talk about equilateral, and what I'm using is the equilateral shape, but I'm going to stick in a k-dependent FNL here, which has some running, which kappa is going to have to be a slow roll parameter, so that'll be kappa will be fairly small.
And a reminder of what slow roll inflation predicts. So detecting either large non-Gaussianity or non-Gaussianity, which is of and or non-Gaussianity, which is not of the local shape, tells you that something other than slow roll inflation is going on. So the possibility of having scale-dependent non-Gaussianity gives new importance to using multiple probes of non-Gaussianity. Here I've plotted these crossed out current. These are the 3-year WMAP bounds on the equilateral shape. But the CMB constrains non-Gaussianity at the largest scales. Galaxy clusters constrain non-Gaussianity at much smaller scales. And the galaxy bispectrum will constrain non-Gaussianity at the scale somewhere in between. This, of course, the lower bound depends on the volume of the survey, and the upper bound here depends on how well you can model into the nonlinear regime. Okay. So the motivation for this project is we're going to look at galaxy clusters to constrain non-Gaussianity, the idea being that perhaps there is non-Gaussianity, which is below the scales currently probed by the CMB, but grows on small scales. So perhaps there's something that evades these bounds, but might show up out here. So 2 points. One, it's important to look at non-Gaussianity at different scales. But even if non-Gaussianity doesn't depend on scale, it's also just experimentally, it makes sense to use different probes because the systematics in going out and counting numbers of objects is very different than the systematics in taking correlation functions, or not exactly correlation functions, but complicated estimators like CMB. Yeah.
Yellow or the orange?
What's that?
How did you determine that yellow orange dash region?
So it's the so these are, I guess, the linear scales. So I check what scales. If I look at a particular mass range for clusters, that's going to select particular scales. And right, so you can relate mass
to
radius.
So it's the top hat window function.
It's a top hat window function.
I think those two power laws, are they motivated in any way or just pure?
So these are, so in DBI model where the brain is falling into the stroke, that gives you a negative kappa, which is a scale, which means that you grow on small scales. So I've just picked, this is kappa of 0.1 and kappa of 0.3. Sarah might have something more to say about that. And I think in a real model, kappa will change, it will be constant.
So isn't that too big? I mean, is that consistent with, I know you can tune parameters, but if you have a large learning of CS, doesn't your amplitude also run very fast?
The amplitude of the scalar spectral index?
Yes.
So the scalar spectral index depends on the three slow roll parameters, the sum of the three. So presumably, I'm just assuming the other two cancel, because we don't have any of them constrained independently. So let me move on. How do you constrain non-Gaussianity from galaxy clusters?
So first, how do galaxy clusters know about non-Gaussianity? A galaxy cluster is the largest collapsed objects in the universe that we detect, and they form when the density fluctuation, delta, smoothed on some scale, is above the threshold for collapse. Okay, so that's illustrated here on this plot. If delta is bigger than delta C, then a cluster will form. And what I've plotted here, of course, is a Gaussian distribution. If I had a positively skewed distribution, the tail lifts a little bit, and the peak here shifts back. To compensate, but you can see there's more area in the tail. And if I have a negatively skewed distribution, there's less area in the tail. Okay, so galaxy clusters, the number of clusters is telling you about the area in this probability and the tail of the probability distribution. So how do we get at cluster number counts? Well, given a probability distribution for the smooth density fluctuation, you can compute using a Prescheckter formalism the mass function, which is the number of objects with a given, the number density of objects with a mass in this range. And given the number density of objects with given masses, you can integrate above some mass threshold and ask how many clusters will I find with a mass which is bigger than a limiting mass threshold. And this is easier to measure than this is. So our recipe for the mass function is to recover a probability distribution function given this smooth skewness. Now, we're going to recover an approximate probability distribution function because we're only including the smooth skewness, and I'll come back to that later. We follow the Prescheckter approach. So Prescheckter asserts that the fraction of volume which is collapsed into objects of mass m is proportional to the area and the tail of that probability distribution function. From the fraction of volume that's collapsed into objects of mass m, you can compute the number of objects in a given mass range. Now, the Prescheckter mass function is known to not be perfectly accurate. It underpredicts the number of objects on large mass scales and overpredicts on small scales. So we don't actually want to use the Prescheckter mass function. There are other mass functions which are calibrated on simulations or have more complicated models of collapse. So instead, we're going to use this approach to compute the non-Gaussian mass function, and then we'll take the non-Gaussian mass function and the Gaussian mass function, both computed from this approach, and just apply that ratio to a preferred mass function. Just hope that that's the way it works. So difficulties are that if I only know the variance and the skewness, I presumably there are higher contributions to the, that doesn't, so a Gaussian distribution is very special in that you only need the variance to describe it. But once I allow for non-Gaussianity, there might be many other cumulants that I need to derive the probability distribution. So I'll get a PDF which has a limited range, which is going to, the probability distribution function is approximate, so the mass function will have a limited range of mass and redshift. So the idea is this is to examine how well cluster number counts can be used to constrain non-Gaussianity on a different scale. But in principle, simulations should be done if you want to make comparisons between observations and theory. So how do you recover the probability distribution? Well, there's a well-known Edgeworth expansion, which is a way of taking a known PDF and expanding about it to get a new probability distribution function. So here, you expand about a Gaussian, and we have these terms which depend on the smooth skewness, S3, and the smooth kurtosis, and so on. And there are infinitely many terms in this series. We are going to truncate at this term. Okay? So we're going to compute S3. And while in principle we can include all orders of S3 terms, in principle given S3, we could also include this S3 squared term, for example. We don't want to do that because seen as an expansion in sigma, if I include this term, I should also include this term. Okay. So I'm going to define the regime of validity of our mass function to be the case where the difference, if I include this term, sorry, the correction from having neglected this term becomes of order 5%. Okay. And that seems fairly conservative because that's allowing, when this term becomes of order 5%, then we'll say that we worry about our mass function being valid. So what do we get? Here's the Prescheckter Gaussian case mass function. Here's our non-Gaussian mass function with that first term and the skewness. What does having non-Gaussianity do to the mass function? Well, sigma here is a function of mass. It's a decreasing function of mass. So as I go to larger mass scales, sigma becomes smaller. So ignore this term for just a second. This coefficient has the same sign as this for most models we consider. If S3 is positive, I have a positive FNL. That if I'm at low masses where sigma is large, this term dominates. So a positive non-Gaussianity has the effect of decreasing slightly the number of objects at low mass scale. Well, as I go to high masses, this sigma is dropping off rapidly. So at large masses, this term dominates. So having a positive skewness is going to increase the number of objects at high mass. Okay? And negative non-Gaussianity would do, of course, the opposite. And for everything we consider, this term is of the same sign. So you can compare whether non-Gaussianity gives you more or less objects just depends on this collapse threshold over sigma, where that hits one, roughly. This is not the MVJ. This is derived from an Edgeworth expansion.
But it's in the approximations that use the approximations.
Okay, so this, the correction that comes in from non-Gaussianity is always this combination of S3 times sigma. So what does this look like? That's plotted here for a few different values of kappa. Remember, kappa is the parameter that quantifies the running of the non-Gaussianity. So if kappa is 0, that means you have scale-independent non-Gaussianity. You get this term, which is pretty flat. Whereas once you allow kappa to change, in particular growing on small scales, you can get quite a drastic change here. So again, these cases here, I've calculated S3 for once given any model of non-Gaussianity, you can calculate what this smooth reduced skewness factor is. This case is for the equilateral model, but if I wanted to, I could use this for FNL or for anything else. You just need to do an integral and get this. So the mass function is more general than that. So what does it look like? Here I plotted, again, these are the WMAP 3 bounds on equilateral type non-Gaussianity. DBI is in green. So for DBI, I've set the sound speed by using the WMAP year 3 bounds on equilateral shape non-Gaussianity. So this is at redshift 0. Here's increasing mass. What's plotted is the ratio of the non-Gaussian mass function to the Gaussian mass function. So of course, you get 1 when there's no in the Gaussian case. And if I have a positive FNL, I have more objects at high redshift, more objects at high mass and a little bit fewer at low mass. And for the negative skewness cases, I get the opposite. You can see that the equilateral shape is a pretty good match to DBI, but actually slightly underpredicts the effect of non-Gaussianity from DBI inflation. If I go to higher redshift, the effect is more drastic. Okay, as I go to even higher redshift, the effect of non-Gaussianity on the mass function goes down to lower masses because you're looking out further in the tail of that distribution. These gray shaded areas indicate where corrections from not including that second term reach 5%. So clearly, when your mass function becomes invalid depends on the magnitude of the non-Gaussianity. So the two different shaded regions are just two different cases, two different values of FNL and kappa. But you can see that even though it becomes invalid, it doesn't go totally crazy. And roughly, just a second. So in any of the observables that we calculate, I find that when you have to worry about the regime of validity of the mass function is roughly when the correction from non-Gaussianity becomes of order 40%. I think that makes sense. Yeah.
So if the observer overestimates the mass by, say, 5%.
So higher and higher redshift, you get a more drastic effect of non-Gaussianity, but you also can't go out as far in the tail of the mass distribution. Okay? So here's the mass function. That's at 40% correction. People actually measure rather than the mass function, but the total number of clusters above some mass threshold, just because there's uncertainty in the mass resolution. So this is an easier quantity to measure. Here, I've assumed a mass threshold, which is independent of redshift. I'm told this is roughly reasonable for SBT, but it might be a little bit optimistic. So here's the cumulative number of clusters for a bunch of these different models. Black, again, is the Gaussian case. You can see that the effect of non-Gaussianity is both to change the total amplitude of this function, but also it shifts the location of the peak a little bit. And for cases which have stronger running of the sound speed, you get a much more drastic effect. And here's that plot again, but looking at the ratio, which is just a little bit easier to detect. Here, 40% change at redshift of a half. Is that detectable? We'll have to take into account other uncertainties in cluster number counts. And here's that ranges where these different mass functions become invalid. But roughly, it's sort of below the 60% change, below the 40% change, and above that is where you start to worry. So to take into account whether this is observable, you have to do something slightly more rigorous. So for example, if the mass threshold is imperfectly known, for example, if the mass threshold for my survey is a little bit larger than I thought it was, I'll observe fewer clusters than I was expecting. Okay, so I don't want to mistake observing fewer clusters than I was expecting for a negatively skewed non-Gaussianity. Similarly, the cluster number counts are very sensitive to sigma 8, which is the amplitude of fluctuations. So if the amplitude of fluctuations is larger or smaller than you thought it was, you will observe more or fewer clusters than you expected. Fortunately, as you can see, while the
the amplitude, sorry, well, the correction is does something similar to the mass function. The redshift dependence is different here, so you might hope to disentangle those effects. In particular, this one, if you could break your, if you had fairly good mass resolution and you could break up your survey into mass bins instead of just saying everything above some mass, I might be more likely to examine that. So to quantify this effect, we did a Fisher matrix analysis for several different models of non-Gaussianity. What's plotted here are different models. The top row all has no running of the non-Gaussianity, and the bottom row all has kappa of minus 0.3. The difference between these, this is the minus 256, which was the WMAP year 3 2 sigma bound, and plus 332, which is the WMAP year 3 2 sigma bound. And this is plotted here as the central value. So just focus on one for a second. Here's the most optimistic case. If the magnitude of the non-Gaussianity is large in amplitude, and the running is large in amplitude, and or the running is large in amplitude, then you have a fairly good chance of constraining it. Although these are, the blue curves are using WMAP priors. We marginalize over omega matter, sigma 8, H, and the mass uncertainty. And the red are using Planck priors. But these are one sigma contours. So in Ichiro's language, even if you have a very large running of the non-Gaussianity and a large amplitude, this is probably a hint or perhaps a two sigma detection. If the amplitude of the non-Gaussianity is smaller, it's going to be much harder to constrain. Okay? So you can, so clusters are actually not, I mean, at least if you look at this where you just calculate the S3 value, the difference between local and equilateral is a few in order of, so a given value of FNL in local is going to produce a larger effect. You also, this is also, we marginalized over slightly different parameters than they, I mean, we included H, which actually I found makes a difference. Yeah, marginalizing over it. And also we have two parameters here. We have both FNL and the running of it. So, yeah. But, so Jingong asked me how well, in principle could you do, in principle, if I was only asking what, how well I can constrain FNL from clusters and all other parameters were perfectly known, you could get sigma of FNL of like 10. But the problem is there are just all these other realistic uncertainties. And once you include them, your sensitivity goes way down. Let me quickly move on to other things we're thinking about. So another way of detecting primordial non-Gaussianity in large-scale structure is to look at the matter bispectrum, which in principle actually contains more information because the clusters are just sensitive to sort of the smooth overall amplitude of non-Gaussianity, whereas the bispectrum retains that geometry dependence on whether you have squeezed or equilateral triangles. Unlike calculating the mass function, the bispectrum doesn't, I only have to know the primordial bispectrum and evolve it to today, not like that mass function where in principle I need to know the kurtosis and all of those higher moments, although there's a star here, I'm going to come back to that. So the bispectrum is nice because it avoids the issue of expanding the PDF. But I should say it's also hard to measure. I think at present nobody has done it for Sloan yet. Is that right?
What do you mean?
Nobody's measured the bispectrum for Sloan yet is my example of. I think the three-point function has been measured, but I don't think that. Any case, this in principle contains more information, but there are other issues as well that come into getting the galaxy bispectrum and converting that into dark matter. So to remind you, when I'm talking about the matter bispectrum, what I mean is the matter fluctuation, which is the fluctuation of matter density divided by the average. And this is related to the curvature by something like Poisson's equation. So we evolve the curvature to the present, and then you can relate the two by that. What does it look like if I take the three-point function that defines the bispectrum here? Now, there are actually two contributions, one due to primordial non-Gaussianity, and another, which is evolved non-Gaussianity because nonlinear, because gravitational evolution becomes nonlinear. A more useful thing to consider is actually the reduced bispectrum, where I take the bispectrum and I divide by these permutations of the power spectrum. And the reason that's nice is that in a matter-dominated universe, the gravitational contribution has this particularly simple form, which is actually constant. So the evolved primordial contribution goes like FNL, I have k squared from Poisson's equation, and then I have this function t of k, which is the transfer function, which relates modes which enter the horizon during radiation domination to those that enter the horizon during matter domination.
What does this look like? So the solid black line is the gravitational contribution that you would have for Gaussian initial conditions. And then I plotted a few different values of FNL, positive here and negative, with different values of the running. So note, in this case where I have K1 equals K2 equals K3, the local and equilateral forms agree. So you would see for the equilateral case with no running, that would be this dotted line here. The interesting thing, I think, is that once you allow scale dependence, if I look at this function, if I ignore the K dependence up here, the amplitude of the primordial contribution is always decreasing. Okay. Whereas if I allow this K dependence here, if kappa is negative, then at some small scale, the amplitude of the primordial part is dropping off, but then at some small scale, it actually turns around again. So that's an interesting feature that shows up in these cases. Here is looking at that triangle dependence again. So here I fixed the amplitude of K1 and K2. K3, by that triangle relation, is fixed to be the sum of those two. And I'm looking at, this is the bispectrum as a function of the angle between K1 and K2, looking around. So here, the solid line is the gravitational part. The dashed lines are for an equilateral model, and the dotted are for local. So you can see the shape dependence is pretty different. In particular, the equilateral case goes to zero at the edges of this triangle. And then the green is a DBI. So the bispectrum also has something, should also be looked at if you're looking for a primordial non-Gaussian. That's right, the gravitational part of second order perturbation theory. So some other things along these lines that I've been thinking about are that actually I told you that the primordial bispectrum, that the evolved bispectrum doesn't rely on knowledge of higher order correlation functions. You only need the variance. But actually, that's not quite true. If I want to calculate even just the two-point function today, that I'm going to have, I can use the evolution equations, the Euler equation, the continuity equation, and Poisson's equation, and I can evolve the linear, if I want to calculate the two-point function, I need to use perturbation theory to understand the evolution. And while the first order term, as long as delta is small, is just the linear evolution of the density fluctuation, actually, I'm going to have corrections which depend on higher order endpoint functions. Okay? So the fact that there's a primordial bispectrum is going to enter here as a first correction to the power spectrum. I'll also, of course, have corrections, even for just Gaussian evolution, I'll have a correction which depends on the four-point function here. So if I'm looking at, as nonlinear evolution becomes more and more important as you go to smaller scales. So if I go to smaller scales, the amplitude of delta is larger. So at scales where delta is near one, I can't just truncate the series anymore. So primordial non-Gaussianity makes nonlinear evolution and large-scale structure harder because I can't just calculate that first term. But I mean, nonlinear evolution is sort of hard anyways, but I think it's interesting to think about what the effects of having this might be and constraints on that. In particular, if I'm thinking about even simulations, if I want to do simulations for a local form of non-Gaussianity, I can imagine generating a realization of this Gaussian random field, and then I can turn that into a non-Gaussian field and ask what it looks like. But if I want to know about clusters, I'm actually looking at things, or the non-linearly evolved power spectrum, I'm looking at a regime where I have to worry about more terms in that perturbation expansion. So it might actually matter whether, well, this in principle could define a non-Gaussian field. The difference between having this, for example, and a case where I included a higher order term become important when you look at higher terms in that perturbation expansion. So knowing whether this is your non-Gaussianity or this might be an issue when you look into the nonlinear regime. Other methods that more people here will talk about, primordial non-Gaussianity affects the halo bias, which is probably easier to measure in the power spectrum. There's this back reaction correction from primordial non-Gaussianity on the power spectrum. And I look forward to hearing what other people have to say about that. So in conclusion, models of inflation produced with sound speed, which is not equal to one, can produce a large non-Gaussianity. So that's interesting because it's motivated, but it's also interesting, just a phenomenological question to ask what the effect of scale-dependent non-Gaussianity is. We looked at a few different ways of constraining this. and came up with a mass function which works for any type of non-Gaussianity, except that it's an approximation, so simulations will need to be done to make any precise predictions. But I actually, thinking about it now, I still think it's useful to have this because you have, with that mass function, I have an idea of if there was a primordial kurtosis, when would I have to worry about it, or what scales? So even though it's approximate, it gives you some sense of which regimes, in any case, be valid. So that's all. Thank you. Sorry.
I asked already if someone else has.
You will.
He asked too.
Yes, that you, the drug, I think.
Okay, just this last thing. So GNL, the next term.
Sure.
Say if you had GNL inflationary versus GNL of zero, do you know how much bias in any of your observables data that the cluster found that make?
I mean, in this case, that would. I mean, I guess you can. I think you can work it out. I mean, the expansion should be basically this expansion is not really an expansion in FNL. It's an expansion of FNL and then the square root of the variance of this. And then this term is sort of GNL and the square is actually the variance here. So as you go to places where the variance becomes larger, that's what that term would be. But maybe you don't have that term.
Cluster scales.
I think. Yeah. I mean, if basically, I guess you would start worrying about this term, perhaps, where our mass function became invalid. So at high, very high mass scales.
Okay, this time, not Lena again.